Okay, now wait a minute. You're going to get me in trouble here if people start saying I'm calling customers pigs being fed to a snake. That had nothing to do with it.
That's exactly right.
Okay, I will explain that in just a second, okay?
Welcome to another podcast of The Magic Word. This is Scott Wells, and I want to thank Rob Johnston for sending an email with his suggestion for the subject of this podcast. Rob had sent an email suggesting that we talk with Emery Williams about brick-and-mortar magic shops and how that he has developed his magic shop on wheels. I thought perhaps it might be interesting to get a couple of other perspectives from other dealers around the country, so I contacted Steve Lancaster with Top Hat Magic in Tulsa and Danny Haney with Danny and Lee's Magic Studio. So I think you might enjoy this particular podcast about the evolution of brick-and-mortar magic shops, their current state, and a perspective of their future, at least from three different people who currently own magic shops, brick-and-mortar magic shops, that is. So if you have a suggestion for something that you'd like to hear on the Magic Word podcast, then please drop a note to me at themagicword@scottwells.com. In the meantime, thanks again, Rob, and thank you, the listener. Now enjoy The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word Podcast, and today I've got from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the Top Hat Magic Shop, Mr. Steve Lancaster. Hi there, Steve.
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. And I know it's cold and chilly up in Tulsa right now with snow and ice and sleet, huh?
Yes, it is. So it was a good time to be doing this.
Good. Perfect timing. Well, I wanted to talk about your magic shop because you've been in business for, gosh, as long as I've known you or so, that since back in the 70s. When did you first open?
1977, April. Actually, it was right real close to April 1st, which was an accident.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. April Fools. So that perfect time. And speaking of that, you opened it exclusively pretty much as magic shop at that time without having a lot of other types of novelties. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. We sold some jokes and gags, but all what we call the clean ones. We didn't sell any adult novelties. And I was told that, I wouldn't make it without it. And I just didn't feel like, it was a right place to sell magic and sell adult novelties at the same place because you associate kids with magic. Even though the majority of my customers are adults, kids come in there with their moms and dads, and they want to see some magic. And so they're walking by the adult novelties, and I don't care if you do have them in a little separate area. They still see them.
Sure.
So I did, and we did, and we did just fine without it, and actually had people thank me for not having them because they'd been in other stores around the country and did appreciate that.
And so your shop exclusively was for magic. Now, I think that it's important that people recognize the way that magic shops were really the place where people could go, magicians in particular, or those who wanted to be magicians, could go and kind of hang out with others and learn from them. I mean, we, of course, didn't have the Internet or anything like that. You had a magic club that would meet, you know, once a month or something, but the magic shop was open every day. It was a place to hang out and learn and tell stories.
Exactly. And help the customer out, especially the new ones, kind of be there for them and help train them. And like the instructions we had talked about once, how the instructions were not sometimes the best instructions or just gave something really basic. And so I would help them, here's a better way to do this. Here's an easier way to do this. And I loved helping the customers. And I had to learn how to do that. It's different when you're selling magic and when you're performing magic. When you're performing magic, it's all about you, you know, the performer.
Right.
And doing the presentation and you're entertaining people. When you're selling magic, you're not entertaining them. You're selling them. And it's all about them and teaching. And so I make sure I do a little qualification thing, qualify them, which I learned through the jewelry business, was that you qualify people. And it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing for the customer because you say, are you new to magic? What's the last thing you bought? What do you like doing? Who do you do this for? You do it for children? Do you do it at church? Do you do it corporate stuff? Or are you working bars? And, or are you just doing it for fun? You know, so I would qualify them and I try to sell them something that would be successful for them, to make them successful, so they'd want to come back and get their magic fix, I called it.
Well, you did have a pretty good, interesting background, I guess, in order to open up a magic shop, because you had worked, as I recall, for a newspaper there in Tulsa, and then having a jewelry background. So you had sold advertising and knew how to engage with the general public in retail sales, I guess, plus, well, I mean, both going in and selling to the ads to the customers as to, for the print ads, as well as going and selling jewelry.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly right. And so once I figured that out, how to sell the person instead of and not entertain them, which was hard to do. You want to entertain people when you're an entertainer.
Sure.
I love magic, but it worked well. And the main reason I started the store was, number one, there was no stores in Tulsa at that time, but so I could bring lectures in. I loved doing that, and we got to meet the lectures. Our very first lecture was Jerry Anders, and so that was another way to help stimulate magic in Tulsa and the art of magic. Mm-hmm. And so the store's way back in the 70s, some of these guys weren't the best, nicest guys. There's nothing, you know, there was a lot of great magicians that ran magic shops. You know, Magic Incorporated was always been great. You know, Jay Marshall was a great guy. And but there were some places that didn't care what they sold the guy. They just want to sell him, the kind of blow in the dust off of something. Here, let's get rid of this and sell it to him. And I thought, you know, from my background in retail of selling advertising, I was around successful retailers. And the one thing I figured out, too, was that, number one, you run it like a real business. If you need to go get something for lunch, you just don't take $5 out of the drawer and go do it. You got to be accountable, especially if you have employees. You cannot balance the day if you're taking money out of there. So how do you know they're not stealing from you? So I ran the store like a business, and I was just an employee there, and that was very successful too, because also I could find out how we were doing. You know, were we making money? Were we not making money? And so the store was bright. It was in a good part of Tulsa. Some of these little places were in like dungy little alleys and places, and are not the best part of the city. And they always were dark and dirty, mm-hmm. or seemed that way. And again, with adult novelties. So I had a bright store, nice looking, everything. Was pristine condition, and if I also I had great customer service. If someone had a problem with something, I would help them with it. And if they brought something back and didn't like it, I'd let them exchange it for something else. Very few people actually bought magic just to see how it works. It was a very small percentage, maybe two people out of all the 30 some years that I've had it happen. Most people want to be successful with their magic. That's why they're in there. So I want to help them, and I think that's what helped our business. Because running it like a real business.
And now, a little at a time, you decided to start adding costumes, and was that something that you had an idea to do, or how'd that come about?
That was Joe Stevens. I have to give him credit for that. He called me up one day and said, "Steve, you need to have some of these Halloween masks." They were made by Don Post, and he was like the only mask maker in the United States. They were all made USA. Nothing was made overseas like it is today. And these masks, though, sold for $65 to $80.
Wow.
But they were a replica of like the Frankenstein and from the old Hollywood movies, and he had the rights on it. So he sent me six and said, take them. If you don't sell them, send them back. If you do, just send me a check. And Joe was great that way. And so I got the six in, and I couldn't believe it. We sold them so fast. So I think it was like next week. I said, okay, I'm sending you a check for the six. Send me another dozen. And it just evolved from there. We got a few clown costumes. We got a few gorillas. And then it evolved into Halloween evolved by, as you remember, people would put things into candy like razor blades and needles and stuff. So
yeah, there was a time in which people were having problems with trick-or-treating, and that was a bad time.
And what happened was the reaction, it's funny how things, negative turns into a positive, parents started having home parties for the kids. And then somebody said, well, let's wear a costume, too, the parent did. Then they go, well, let's have our own party. We'll have the kids' party. We'll have our party. And so it started growing and evolving. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then I decided to make a major commitment, which I did. And that was how I got started.
And so did you stay in the same shop, or did you move to another one that was expanded size?
Yeah, we've moved numerous times, always in good areas. I started this little bitty place that was like 600 square feet. That's all I could afford. and but it was kind of hidden. And so there was a right across the street was a big shopping center that had a big pizza place, and also a Mexican that was called Casa Bonita and Crystal's Pizza, and it was huge. And they did a great job of customer service. So there's a space open right across, right next to them, about two doors down. So I moved over there, stayed there for a number of years, and then someone bought the property and decided to take out the front parking and let's put in flower beds. Well, that was a mistake because my business dropped 25% because people want to park in front of the store.
Sure.
And so so then we moved again, and I had another store on Peoria, bought out a costume company that was over there. And so we had two stores. So then I went down to one store. It was over in the another part of town. But I found out people wouldn't in East Tulsa would not drive over to West Tulsa. And so I decided I took a look at a map and saw the cross-section of I-44 and 51, and it crossed. And so I put a circle around that, and I found a space there. And so we moved there, and then we actually moved again one more time in that same area. A better thing came open, and so that I said to myself then, that's the last time I'm moving. But I then moved to a smaller place, which was different for me. That's another thing, was it was difficult. It's always easy to move into bigger. Let me tell you, going from 6,500 square feet down to 1,200 square feet, that was hard.
Yeah.
Because I had to make decisions of what to get rid of. But it all worked perfect. Everything was fine.
But the way that you were growing to begin with, you needed the larger size as you became the largest costumer in all of Oklahoma.
I did, yes. And it worked well for a while, but then business started hurting. My overhead was going up. The manager wanted to raise the rent a little bit and plus go 5-year lease. And I made a radical change. I just said, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to get out of this. I think it's time to get out of this business. I think it's and some people thought I was – it was sad for me. I said, don't be sad. This is a major decision. So we sold all the costumes off 2 years ago and had the best October I ever had in my life because we sold everything off and people were happy. And there was a few things I gave to some schools and churches that had theater groups. I just didn't want to throw stuff away that was good. And so we did that, and it shrunk down. And it works fine now.
Right, but going back, I guess, then to where that you first started growing after you got the masks and then you started buying some more suits, I guess, started going to some Halloween trade shows or things, or how'd that business grow?
Yeah, well, now there's a Halloween show that they have every year, but and it has been going on for years, and it's moved to different cities before, but back then there was not a Halloween show. It was a gift market, and I think it was Joe Stevens, said he goes there, and there's some people that sell some costumes there and sell some magic and novelties, like the joke and gag, like the hand buzzer, stuff like that. And so I'd go there, and one of the companies was Loftus. They were really good. So we started buying some clown costumes and gorilla costumes, and started real small. And then a company called Ruby's, they showed up one day in the front door. The president of the company had a motorhome, and he had a little showroom built in his motorhome. And showed me these costumes. And I was like, wow, these are great. But they were running like, you know, back then it was $200 for a costume for rental. That was a lot of money. So we bought a few, and we grew and grew. And finally I went to Howard Vage, which was the president, and I said, hey, I need to really get into this thing. I think it's going to be here for a while. And he goes, it is going to be here for a while, and it's going to keep growing. And so we grew together, and he's now the largest international distributor of costumes. And we grew up, so to speak, together, and we're still friends today. He's helped me out a lot, along with Joe Stevens, helped me out a lot. And so we were the largest, and we kept growing and growing. And then the economy changed, and we went through some bumps back in the 80s when the oil crunch hit, and got through that just fine. So I've been through with some ups and downs. I'm not too worried about them, but to the fact that you have to be realistic in business. And so now we have competition with the internet. We have competition with these big stores coming in from a Halloween point of view, and these big district people. And there is that perception that we talked about that it's cheaper at these big stores because they're like they look like a Walmart, you know, or something like that. But they were not cheaper. But people didn't know that. They didn't shop around. I did have some regular customers that would come back and say, you know, I made a mistake. They also, it was really funny. They'd almost apologize. Oh, I'm so sorry. I went to the other place. I didn't know they'd gone there, you know. Mm-hmm. And they said, it's okay. It's okay. It's all right. And I'll never go back there again. Okay, well, fine. And so I had a lot that would do that, loyal customers. But there was a lot of people out there because of the economy that they had to buy something inexpensive and cheap. And even though it maybe wasn't, but in their mind it was. And perception is everything, as we've learned through like places like Walmart. You can sometimes pay too much for something, and you can also get a great deal there. So you got to shop around. And some people don't like shopping around. It's funny. They don't.
And so then a little at a time, what happened was that you could see that this was not going to be a good business model as far as having to compete with those big box stores and these fly-by-night Halloween superstores.
Yes, and it did hurt us. And the world has changed, too. The economy's, you know, it's tough on a lot of people. The piece of pie in Halloween is eaten up by all these stores coming in. And so the costume rentals was down and the retail was dang about the same. And so I thought, you know, if I cut my overhead back, I can keep going. Otherwise, I might be out of business if I kept going this way.
Right.
And so when you analyze the business, my lease was up. I always liked to, I never walked out on a lease ever. I always, you know, did that, and I believe in that because it's too small a world. And you get a good reputation too by doing that. So we downsized.
Which is where you are then now with pretty much back to what you were to begin with, the smaller store exclusively selling magic with a little bit of a website and, I guess, an online presence to supplement that.
Yes, and we do sell a lot of theatrical makeup. We still kept that. Magic and theatrical makeup is kind of head in head with each other. It's amazing. Mm. How much we sell. So, but yeah, we do internet sales. I also manufacture some magic props, the Flaming Book and Flaming Bible that got permission from Paul Diamond. He was the guy that used to make those, and he used to use a lighter to light them. And then he had an igniter. And then, I called him and said, hey, I need some more books, Paul. Where are they? And he said, well, I'm not doing that anymore. Here, you can have it. It's yours. If you'll just, you know, and I said, well, thank you. So I had to figure out how to make them and did that. So I made some changes on it. I finally found the igniter that would work best for it. And it took about 4 or 5 years to make that work. Mm-hmm. And a lot of money that, you know, I never got back. It's you invest into it.
Research and development.
Yeah, so exactly. And so we started making those, and we do well with those. We sell those mostly to distributors, and they sell them to magic shops. And we just said the same thing with the coin bending tool. I made one for myself because I'm getting to the story of how I did that, but actually it was a non-magic person took a coin and bent it and was showing it to people how he could bend coins, and he was really doing a really crude switch, and these people were buying it. They thought he really bent the coin. And so I said, how are you doing that? So anyway, figured out a way to make the coin bending tool, and we sell those. It'll bend any coin, penny, nickel, dime, quarter, half dollar, foreign coins. And of course it's all pre-show, and so we do that, and then the $2 bill trick, which is the two ones and turn to the $2 bill into a $2 bill, and found the original guy on that, and he gave me permission to start making it. So we have that. And I had a couple other gospel effects that we put out that we sell mostly to distributors. So with that, the internet and magic in sales, and I do think I still do private lessons and I still do shows.
So where do you see the future of the brick and mortar magic shop going?
I still think there's a future for magic shops. I know a lot of them are closed down. I don't know why. I don't know if they were very, maybe it is, it's lost interest in it. I don't know. I still have an interest in magic. I love magic. I love the art of magic. I love helping people. I enjoy doing the shows. I enjoy doing the teaching magic lessons. Yeah, it's part of my life. Magic has done so much for me and got me into places I would have never been before. And so I want to share that with other people. This is kind of my way of paying back, of helping the customer. It's a lot more, and a lot of places, is Denny and Lee, they get it. You know, there's a lot of other shops around that get it. They're still going. And I think the ones that didn't maybe they didn't get it. Maybe they're in a bad place. I don't know. But I think there's still a need for magic shops beyond the internet, because you can't get that customer service. You can't get that one-on-one with the internet.
Right.
So I actually have people that go to YouTube and they see some stuff And they come in, and then I show them, you know what, there's a better way to do that. Oh, really? All of a sudden now, you're my customer. So right. These negatives and turn them into positives.
Yeah, it's a customer service that certainly you cannot get over the Internet. You have to get that just one-on-one. Well, that sounds great. Well, it looks like that you have seen kind of the ups and downs and gone through a lot of evolution. It sounds like also I can hear in the background that hail coming down on your roof, it sounds like, through the skylight or something.
Actually, sleet. And I cleaned out the driveway once, and now it's covered back up again, so I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to let it go. It looks like it's going to be this way till tomorrow morning, so that's okay. I'll just snuggle in here.
That's right. Stay warm by the fire. Well, Steve, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast and giving us your perspective from a brick-and-mortar shop yourself.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So that was Steve Lancaster with Top Hat Magic in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And for the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, and I have with me a well-known magic dealer from out in Baltimore, Maryland, Mr. Denny Haney. Hi there, Denny.
How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great, thank you. And you've got the world-famous Denny and Lee Magic Studio that you started out in Baltimore. Was that where you started, actually?
Yeah, I started it here in Baltimore after I retired from the road, and then I opened a satellite shop in Las Vegas.
And that's been open for now about, what, 10, 15 years?
It's been, probably 15 years.
And you have had a couple of different shops out there in Vegas, didn't it move? I mean, it's the same center, I guess. It kind of moved just across.
Well, we're right in the same place. We had a big space, then we had to move to a smaller space, and, we go back and forth, and we move next door. It all depends.
Right. Well, the reason I wanted to talk with you today was just about the brick-and-mortar magic shops and kind of status of what's been happening with them. And there's been obviously a reduction in those over the last several years with the advent of Internet and online purchasing and all that kind of a thing. But I think it's important that we continue to have and support these real brick-and-mortar shops. And you are one of the surviving members.
One of the last.
Yeah. And what do you think makes it special, or why did you expand, even to go over to Las Vegas?
Well, I expanded in Las Vegas because things were going very well when I first opened, before the Internet had this big explosion.
Mm-hmm.
So since I was already there, I just kept it.
Yeah.
And I always have plans of moving out to Vegas and spending my last years there.
And then you'd be closing the one in Baltimore, or just sell that off?
Then I would close the one in Baltimore, but I don't know when that's going to happen or if it's going to happen.
Yeah, you really enjoy where you are, I guess.
I love it here.
Yeah, you're an East Coast guy, even despite the weather.
Well, I don't like the weather, but I have a nice spot here, 10,000 square feet, a full theater with a full stage, and my own room, and I'm just comfortable here, and there's so much stuff, I'd hate to move it.
Yeah, you got all of your stuff and magic posters and everything. I mean, it is really quite a facility that you have there. And, well, let me kind of back up a little bit. As you were saying, when you opened the magic shop then to begin with, that you had a very successful career performing on the college circuit, and then decided for whatever reason to quit and do magic.
The colleges and the corporate events, and we're very successful as an entertainer, as a show. And, I just got tired of the road, and I thought, well, I've reached the age, I was doing well, so I could retire early.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to get off the road and open a magic shop to pass on what knowledge I've learned throughout my career to the younger magicians in the hopes that they would progress and carry it further.
And how do you think that's worked out with your...
Not at all.
Oh, that's got to be...
No, actually, we've turned out quite a few full-time pros out of this shop.
Yeah.
But the majority of the magicians are attracted to the Internet. They're attracted to card tricks and only card tricks and flicking and cutting and flinging and throwing and all that kind of stuff. And the, the magic, the actual performance of magic is really being lost today.
Why would you say that?
Well, it's because it's all about buy a trick, buy a trick, buy a trick, buy a trick. And these video demos that make these tricks look like fantastic miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And guys go on the internet and they see something and go, wow, that's great. So they buy it and they get it and they find out it's impractical for everyday use or takes too long to set up or whatever. But, you know, the real core of magic is still in the old school way of learning magic from books.
And just reading and studying it and working hard.
Read. You know, all you need is the Tarbell Course in Magic and the Fitschke Trilogy, and you're on your way.
That was actually what got me started with. That was the series of books. In fact, whenever I first started doing magic, I was taking some money from a birthday party. I think I had taken a magic class at a local junior college just kind of for the fun of it. And then I started doing a birthday party, and it seems like I charged like $15 because I think it would cost $15, you know, for the first Tarbell book. Then the next one I think was $20, so I charged $20 for my second show. And then the next few books was $20, and then the last one I think was like $25 or something. So,
That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
I tell everyone who comes in this shop, look, you get Tarbell 1.
Yeah.
Next time you're in, you get Tarbell 2. Next time you're in, you get Tarbell 3. And eventually you'll have all 8 of them, but most of the guys are still... To this day, I mean, guys have been in magic 30, 40 years. They're saying, you know, one day I'm thinking about getting that Tarbell course, but they never do.
Wow.
They think about it.
Well, I think that, and you supplement that also with J.B. Bobo's Coin Magic book.
Bobo's Coin Magic, Huger's Royal Road, the classic magic books. This is where the good magic is.
Well, now, I know, of course, that you're selling some popular things, and you have behind the counter different magic props and things that classics, not just the cups and balls, but whatever that the newest little gimmick thing would be, just because you do have those people coming in looking for whatever is going to be new.
Looking for what's new,
Sure. But you are the one, you're always really pushing, saying what you need really are these basic books.
Yes, I try to guide them off of the new things, the new items, and get them into learning magic the correct way.
Well, then the obvious question would be what set of books or what books would be in your, you know, they talk about a 3-foot library. I mean, what would you carry or what were the 10 books if you were going to be on a desert island as far as magic books go or wherever?
Well, there you go. The Tarbell Course in Magic, that's 8 volumes.
Yeah.
The Fitschke Trilogy, that's 3 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, and now if you could squeeze in Bobo's Modern Coin Magic, maybe T. Nelson Down's Art of Magic, Masculine and Devance Our Magic, you know, you could go on and on. Stars of Magic, you could go on and on and on, really, and fill up a good 20 feet of library space with working books.
And what I'm hearing you say, then, it sounds like more books for the working magician and not so much on the history of magic. I mean, I know that you...
Well, I would recommend the history, but if I only have so much space on my library shelf, then I've got to stick with those classics. But definitely the history of magic. Milburn Christopher's Illustrated History of Magic is a great place to start.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get interested in the history and find out how exciting it is, then you get those separate publications, like the book on Blackstone Sr. and the book on the Great Leon. And then you get the book on Alexander, and then you get the Milo and Roger. And you just read the history and the biography and the lives of these great performing magicians. And, you know, it gets into your soul. And when you perform, it just... You know, it just makes you a better performer. I have a deal with guys. I can actually, and honestly, this works.
Mm-hmm.
I can watch a magician perform.
Yeah.
And I can tell whether he reads books or not just by watching him perform.
Really? Now, what is that? What's the little nuance that
gives? I don't know what it is. It's a feeling.
Hmm.
There's a feeling. There's a
that he has a respect for the history and understands the classics.
Yeah, it's in the soul. It's in the soul, and then it comes across the footlights, or it should.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't, then it's they're a bland magician. You know, they're just a magician going through a series of tricks.
Right. What I call a Muzak magician is just kind of background noise.
You got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, have you ever written a book on your own, or have you had any aspiration of writing a book?
Yeah. You know, I started one years ago. But then when I opened the magic shop, I just didn't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. I started it, and it never went any further. Everybody's been after me to write it. In fact, Michael Close got me to write that those 12 articles for a whole year in MUM magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And he said this would be the way to start your book. So actually, Scott Alexander was doing all the writing. He would just come down and interview me and record me. Then he would write it up, and then his wife would grammatically check everything, and then it would be published. But I ran that article for an entire year in MUM magazine, and it they came out great. I got a lot of great complimentary calls about those articles.
Well, that would be a good start, certainly, since you have that, of having those as a few chapters and adding to it. It's because you recall that Jeff McBride had his, what was that, the Doctor of Magic, or Magic is Good Medicine, or something like that. That was Show Doctor. This was, sorry. The
right,
Show Doctor.
Doctor,
it ran for a while, and then he put all those into a book, but then supplemented that with Larry Haas doing some interviews and things like that.
Right.
Those are, that's just a solid book. That's another good one.
Yeah, that's a wonderful book. That and Maximum Entertainment by Ken Weber.
Ken Weber.
Sensational.
Mm-hmm.
Sensational book.
Well, now you're getting into some other things that has to do with the presentation of magic and not just the trick itself. And when you get to
trick,
scripting. And
you know, tricks are a dime a dozen. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget watching an old Mike Douglas television show when I was a teenager. And I saw a chimpanzee come out on stage and do magic tricks.
No way.
He did a dove pan, a square circle, and a couple other things.
Oh, man.
I looked at it and I said, you know, a monkey can do tricks, but a true performer can perform magic.
Quite literally.
You bet.
That's
so
amazing.
Now you can literally say any monkey can do magic tricks. I mean, he can't do, the sleight of hand, you know, multiple back palms of playing cards.
Sure.
But he can do prop magic tricks. So the idea is to create the showmanship and the presentation to make these props interesting and appealing to your audience.
Well, that's another book I really enjoy that goes into the detail on scripting the show and building an act, and that is Henning Nelm's book of Magic and Showmanship.
Oh, sure. Magic and Showmanship, yes.
Mm-hmm. Another one.
Yeah, I knew Nelms. I met him when I was a teenager.
Did you? What kind of a guy was
he? Very, very cruel to me. He was very cruel.
Hmm.
But I learned a lot.
You say cool or cruel?
Cruel.
Cruel. He was mean.
Mean.
To me. Mean. Ah, interesting.
Mean.
Huh. That was just his general nature, huh?
Yeah, he was very into magic. He didn't perform much magic, but he knew theater, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go to college today and you want to study theater,
mm-hmm.
The first book you get on lighting is one that's written by Henning Nelms. It still used to be the general, but you know, you had to have that book.
Yeah, basically.
But I remember getting in a contest when I was a teenager at a magic convention with my billiard balls and cards, and I won, and I was so proud, and I came off, and I couldn't wait for Henning Nelms to say something complimentary, and he jumped all over me because I had red hair at the time, and in my breast pocket of my tails, I had a red handkerchief, 24-inch handkerchief, silk handkerchief, but the two reds were not the same shade, so they clashed.
Wow.
It was one of those little things.
Sure.
That he got on me for, but, you know, a good act is composed of a lot of little minute details.
I recall so many years ago when Johnny Ace Palmer had performed and won first prize, but he did not win the gold cups. And I was talking with the judges afterwards, and one of them said, well, he was dressed to the nines, you know, wore a really nice, clean tuxedo, and he had good productions. The value of his presentation, everything was perfect. However, when he produced these tennis balls, his tennis balls were dirty.
Ah, there you go.
And it was just such a minor thing to him and to some other people,
yes.
But you know, when you're looking at it, if you have a certain presentation that you're trying to persona you're trying to present, if there's a chink in the armor, then it's not perfect, and that's kind of what. So he came back and changed that, and he won.
That's a good lesson, and all the guys listening to this podcast, I'm going to tell you right now, it's time you got a new set of sponge balls. They're filthy.
You know, that's one thing that I tell people is that, you know, sponge balls can be washed. You just use some soap and
yes,
water.
Yes, they can.
I think most people
yes,
just use them.
Yes, they can. Soap and water does miracles.
Oh, my goodness, yes. You know, when I'm working in a restaurant, there have been those occasions in which I ask people to hold this or a sponge ball or
yes.
Whatever it is, and they'll say, ooh, you know, who else has been
that's
holding
right.
this evening? You know, I'm going to be eating dinner. And so, you know, a polite
that's
thing
right.
might even be to have some Purell or something that you can say after you're finished, you know, would you like to, you know,
sure.
use these wipes or something?
Sure.
You know.
I mean, you're dealing with people eating food.
Right.
You
exactly.
better be clean.
Well, back on the brick-and-mortar shops, then, again, there seems to be kind of a, as I said, a demise of this. And, you know, there's a proliferation many years ago. I remember in the 60s and 70s that a lot of these shops sprouted up around, usually in kind of a seedy part of town, it seemed like. And
yes.
they were selling not just jokes, but also novelties and adult toys and things like this. And,
right.
And that kind of a thing in order to keep their lights on.
Right.
And then they started, you know, adding costumes, and then it kind of grew. And
yes.
then it's as if that it had a bad reputation.
Yes. And that was one thing when I opened my shops, I decided I would never do.
Mm-hmm.
No rubber dog crap and no fake vomit, no costumes, no gags. It's all real magic. And we've held on to stuck to our guns
mm-hmm.
all these years. But it's been a tough, tough struggle.
Now, what is your philosophy then as far as displaying some things? I remember going into a magic shop one time and asking about thumb tips, and the guy said, well, they're back here. He doesn't have them
right.
out. There are certain things
right.
that you would not have in your counter for people to question.
Exactly. And in fact, that's one of the things that got me to move to the location here in Baltimore of where I am, because I was on a main street at one time, and too many laymen would come in, and I didn't want them seeing certain things. I still,
mm-hmm.
you know, adhere to the secrecy. And so I moved to an industrial park now. You have to know where I am and seek me out to find me. And so, you know, I'm a little more free here to put things on display.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, we have a saying in the shop, you won't hear about us or find us until you're ready for us.
Kind of like the Zen master. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
That's it. Well, yeah, all the guys call me Yoda anyway.
Yoda man.
Yeah, Yoda man. But it's
well,
amazing how many calls I get from around the world. Guys call me with problems or questions
mm-hmm.
or they need ideas. And, you know, 75% of every answer is, it's in Tarbell.
Going back to the first thing we were talking about. Exactly. It's all,
you bet. It goes right back to that.
It's in the book.
Yeah.
Well, that was, of course, some great advice that Roger Klaus had given me so many years ago, that your best investment in magic is in books.
Oh, always. Always. Mm-hmm. They're there forever. They don't go away unless you have a flood or something. See, now today, everything is internet instant downloads.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? This is temporary information. You're paying for it, but it's only temporary. Eventually, your computer will crash. The way of the media playback procedure, it will be outdated. I find that most people who own downloads and CD-ROMs of magazine files and things like that, e-books and things, they never read them.
Right.
They just have them.
That's kind of like with photos that my wife is always saying, I wish you would print out some pictures that are on your iPad or on
yes.
your phone or something, or on
yes.
your, even on the digital camera. You know, it used to be, of course, that you would drop things off and get a hard copy and you
yep.
have them from there. But it's so easy just to have a digital copy of things. And it's kind of like
sure.
putting things in the attic. It's like, I've got it. There was a movie with George Burns and Brooke Shields. I think it's, Just You and Me, Kid, or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
And I remember that he had some things that were displayed. In particular, there were these battle axes on the wall. And she said, why are these here? He said, well, because I like it. And he said, well, why don't you just put it in the attic? And he said, well, then I couldn't see it. He said,
there it is.
If I have something, I want to be able to look at it. You know, not just
yes.
to store it and say, I've got it. You know,
exactly. I love to look on my shelf and see all these books.
Yes.
I love it. Because I can just at any time reach up and grab one. Mm-hmm. I don't have to go to a machine. I don't have to warm anything up, turn it on, find any menus, click through this file and that file. I can grab a book at any time, open it up anywhere, and just enjoy learning something new about magic.
Exactly. And a lot of things that I have found, I then will bookmark or highlight or something, just like you did when you're in college, you know, that you had certain
right.
books that you had to go back and you'd underline or something. And these are things that I go back to time and again.
Yeah. Yeah. They're there forever.
So, yeah, that is the important, I think, of a brick-and-mortar shop. Certainly that on that line you can buy books and start to stock your library, but the thing is of – I think with a brick-and-mortar shop, when people come into you, that you get to know the customer and vice versa so that you can make certain recommendations saying, you know,
yes.
you know,
I'll tell them what books to buy.
There you go.
And many times I talk them out of a book that they came in to get.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I will talk them out of it after I talk to them a while. You know, if I don't know them.
Yeah.
After I talk to them a while, I find out where they are, and I say, look, you know what? You're going to do better with this. You know, they may be coming in here to buy a $55 book on cards. And I say, you know, do you have the card Magic of LaPaul? And it's only $15. Here's what this is where you're at, you know. And they always thank me for for recommending something like that, because they'll find they get much, much better material out of the books I recommend.
Right. And you know what it is that's going to be best for them, because.
Exactly.
If they walk away with something that they're just not ready for yet.
Right, right.
Yeah, you know, when H&R Magic Books used to be here in Houston, that Dick Hatch and I have been always good and close friends and know each other's style, and we work together in different shows, and so whenever I would go to his shop, that he would, or even sometimes he'd just call me and say, hey, I've got in a book that I was thinking of you, you know, this will fit
yep.
you, you know, this is your
yep.
style, you need, you know,
exactly.
that I know you like this or that kind of a thing, and it's very helpful to have those kinds of recommendations, which, you know, you really can't get then necessarily. One of the advantages also, then, you were talking about you have a 10,000 square foot with a shop, of course, with the showroom and the theater, et cetera, but is just that, of hanging out at a shop along with other
yeah.
guys
yes.
that you really can't get online.
Yeah, hang out, keep your ears open, and listen. I tell everyone, any day you walk into this shop and there's some guys sitting at the table, you'll walk out of here with $1,000 worth of free information just
mm-hmm.
by listening.
Mm-hmm. And the same thing in Las Vegas, there in your shop as well. It's a much smaller shop, but they have a
much
table.
Smaller.
You can sit there and practice and learn and talk with guys. I mean, there are guys coming in constantly and just to buy some stuff or hang out and chat with others.
Sure, sure. And you know, we're starting to lose that now, the social interaction in magic. Because of the internet, and there are guys who have never ever set foot in a magic shop, and they've been in magic maybe 5-10 years
mm-hmm.
and have never been in a magic shop because they don't realize the atmosphere of the shop. They don't know what a good shop is,
mm-hmm.
and they just don't make an effort to go out. They think they can get it all on the internet. It's like they have internet lectures now.
Yes.
And I'm not a fan of them, you know, because you should see a lecturer live, just like a magic show. You've got to experience this live. You know, you can watch Copperfield all day long on television, but when you see that show in person, your jaw drops. Same with Matt King. You know, you're not going to, you can't see his show on the internet. I mean, you can see it, but you're not going to get the pleasure.
It's like with comedy clubs or any kind of live entertainment,
sure.
Whether you're going to see the ballet, a theater, a symphony, to
mm-hmm.
you know, because you are looking at different instruments playing in the symphony and whatever, as opposed
yes.
to just listening to the music on the radio.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we have a very hard time today getting people to come into the shop and
mm-hmm.
hang out.
And it's not just because that it's hard for them to find. It's just that they just don't want to come.
They don't bother. It's too much effort to get in my car and drive there.
But isn't that what magic is all about?
Yeah, exactly. You've got to seek it out.
Yes.
There
has to be
you shall find.
Time and effort, I think, in
yes.
trying to learn magic, that it's not something, if it's easy, it's not worth doing.
Right. I always say there's two ways to do magic. You can buy magic, or you can learn magic, and it's two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So you learn magic, and then you buy the tools that you need. But to buy trick, if you buy 100 tricks, that does not make you a magician.
So as far as the future of brick-and-mortar magic shops, or for that matter, just magic shops in general, obviously we're seeing this proliferation of the boom of the Internet purchasing, and you just mentioned the online lectures and things like that, that people don't need to leave their home or even put on clean underwear, you know.
Right, exactly.
Stay home all the time. Where do you see the direction of this going? Do you think that as people are getting older who owned magic shops, I mean, you know, Paul Diamond and others, you know, who don't run shops anymore, and, you know, let's say the next 20 years that you're not going to be running one in Baltimore or Joe Stevens. I mean, Mark's taken a great job, Mark Stevens with Stevens and Porter,
sure.
But there are just so, there's fewer and fewer brick and mortar shops. And so,
yes.
You know, will there be new people who will take these over? How will they?
I don't know. I really worry about that because I have a feeling that the Internet, this monster of a thing called the Internet that has now created e-books and downloadable books and all of this. I think it's like this. When these technical geniuses invent something new, they invent something and then they go to marketing and they go, okay, now how can we convince everyone in the United States that they need this? That's how they work. And you know, it's not the way. They invent new technology, but then they try to hook the general public on needing it. And we don't need this. You know, Andy Rooney said it once at the end of 60 Minutes. He said, the computer has enabled... Oh, he had to start out with, you know, the computer has created so many things that we can do effortlessly and much quicker. But unfortunately, none of that stuff was ever necessary in the first place. And that's a great statement, because it's true. None of this is necessary. But we just make it, they make us think it's convenient.
It's a way to access information so much quicker, though. I mean, certainly you can do a Google search rather than pulling the encyclopedia
down.
And
but that's what you get on the Internet. Mm-hmm. You get tons of information, but very little knowledge. And it's two different things. Having information is not having knowledge. You know, it's like the guy that goes to school and takes history, and he memorizes dates and battles, and all he is, he's a memorizer.
Yeah.
So he can spout off what year this battle took place and what year this happened and that happened. Now, is he an expert on history? No. He just knows a bunch of facts.
Well, some attorneys are that way too, which that it seems like that they can absorb and
refer
memorize.
Refer to the books. Refer to the predecessors. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's important with the books to know where things are. Just as I was saying earlier, when you know, I've got something that's like, okay, I remember that there was this particular trick that I did, and I go and pull out Jim Steinmeier's book or something and say, okay, yes, this was what it was, and I've got a bookmark and go back into it, or something that Max Maven had taught, you know. So, but remembering and knowing where that information is, you know, in the catalog of my mind, you know, I think is important to know.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. Mm-hmm. It's very, very important to know generally where something is.
Yeah.
And that's what you use your library for, research.
Sure.
It's not for learning this trick, learning that. It's research.
Right, right. And so you really, it sounds like you don't have an answer as to the direction of where you think...
I don't have an answer. It frightens me. Yeah. It frightens me that there may never be... once they're closing down left and right, you know, and these guys are learning not to go to a magic shop because magic shops are closing. So they have no other alternative but to go to the Internet, and then you become hooked, and then that becomes the way to learn magic. They don't know what they're missing because they've never experienced it.
Right.
It's like if you've never tasted chocolate, you don't know if you're missing it or not.
That's right.
Once you get your first taste of chocolate, you go, wow, that's really good. I'm going to get more. And that's the way a magic shop is. You have to come in. You have to experience it. Then you know what you're missing and what you should be doing.
Right. Unfortunately, you said that not enough people are coming in to maintain those profits and to pay the lease and the light bill and exactly. everything else to keep those open. And so there are fewer and fewer people who are coming in doing that. So it sounds like from the gloom and doom that I'm hearing is that it's going to go the way of buggy whips and it just
I think it is.
Hmm.
Well, now, one day in the future, some enterprising young man somewhere may decide to open a real magic shop without gags and costumes. And it may spark a whole new trend. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, things go in circles. You know, life goes in circles. But the internet, as good as it is, has become a very, very habit-forming thing. You go on YouTube. Let's say you go on YouTube for a good purpose, to look up Fred Capps, and you want to see Fred Capps perform, one of the greatest magicians of all time.
Right.
Well, you watch him. But then it links you to something else that's interesting and something else. The next thing you know, you've spent 4 hours on YouTube. And all you've wanted to do was watch Fred Capps.
Sure, sure.
So I have a saying. People tell me they don't have time to read a book. They don't have time to do that. They don't have time to – the reason people don't have time is because they're too busy wasting it.
Not keeping focused.
Exactly. They're not focusing.
One thing that you may have sparked here is an idea of, let's say that in the future, that there would be somebody who is able to open a magic shop that people would want to go to. I think an idea might be, let's say that you had created an image in the public eye such that people wanted to come and have a piece of you. You know, that has to do like with concerts, you know, after rock concerts or just back of the room sales, basically, that people, or even magic lectures for that matter, people will buy the notes and maybe never look at them again, but they want to have a piece of that memory they had at the time. So they'll buy a T-shirt, they'll buy a CD or whatever.
Yeah.
And so if let's use Chris Angel as an example of someone who is in the popular eye of the public. And so if he were to open up a chain of magic shops, I think people would go into the Chris Angel.
Oh, they would go into them because he's Chris Angel. Yeah.
Exactly, because he has the
name. But the problem is they're going to get all that stuff that they don't need.
Well, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, exactly. It depends upon, you know, what kinds of things they would carry and how profitable that could be. But I'm just saying that could be a model if you have somebody who is coming in, just like with a sports figure, you know, that is very popular, that would open up their own restaurant. People go into that chain because it's Michael Jordan's. He used to have the place. Or it used to be, you know, in St. Louis, Stan and Biggie's. Stan Musial had a place or whatever it is. Well, I'm sounding old now, aren't I? But anyhow, that different sports figures would have a place and people go in just because they want that. And so if a person was well known in the public eye as a magician, that people might come to their magic shop at least once or twice or, you know, stop in to pick up something or whatever that might be. But maybe that might be something in the future that would be a brick and mortar shop. But do you find that being out of the way is better or worse? Or do you think that magic shops should be on the main traffic?
No, area? I think they should be hidden.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that people should make an effort to go to the place, to go to the shop. They must make an effort. If it's effortless, just walking down the street and you see a magic shop and you walk in, it's you're attracting the wrong kind of people.
Right. Right.
They must develop an interest, and if they're interested enough to look me up and to find me, when they walk into this door and through this door, I know they made an effort.
Right. Well, that goes back to what we were saying earlier, that it shouldn't be easy. Anything worth doing is worth working for.
Right.
In order to be successful in it, it shouldn't just necessarily be coming easy. However, that the more you enjoy it, the easier it will become for you, and you'll find success, I think, in it.
Yeah,
certainly. So again, as far as your future goes, that your kind of a long-term plan would be to eventually close up the one in Baltimore and then move out to sunny Las Vegas.
Yeah. That's exactly what my plans are, but I don't know when I'm going to do it. One of the things that was preventing me from moving was my pet potbelly pig.
Yeah.
And she just passed away last week.
I was just about to ask how she's doing. I'm sorry to hear that, because she was...
She died last week.
18 years old, or how old?
18 years old, yes, indeed.
Yeah, I remember.
I slept with her every night for 18 years, and I loved her, and I sure do miss her.
Yeah, no, she was a great asset around the office over there. Everybody, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, I'm sorry,
what was her name again? It was...
Baby, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That was my baby,
Sorry to hear. Well,
so that sort of frees me up now to do whatever I want. But like I say, it all depends on what happens. If the internet keeps bombarding these guys with things, and you know, it's funny. I have a lot of sayings, but one of my sayings is, you know, guys go on the internet and they think they're going to get this great deal. Oh, look how cheap this is. Look how cheap this is. And they're usually getting stolen or knockoff stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I say every time I think I'm buying the Holy Grail for a good price, I end up with a plastic cup.
That is true. That is so true. Because magicians are always looking for that Holy Grail of magic tricks.
Yes, they always are. Mm-hmm. And there is no Holy Grail. The only you look in the mirror. That's what's going to make you a magician, you.
You know what I used to say as far as business goes and people, you know, moving jobs, that there's no greener grass, just different shades of brown.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, Denny, thank you very much. I appreciate your input and your advice and your perspective.
My pleasure.
So
I hope guys will get in their car and drive out to a magic shop and hang out.
Yes, keep them alive for as long as possible.
As long as possible.
Support your brick and mortar.
Yes, indeed.
There you go. Well, that was Denny Haney from Denny and Lee's Magic Studio out in Baltimore, Maryland. And this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast saying, Scotty out. Right now I've got with me as my guest, Mr. Emery Williams from Williams Magic Company, or I guess it's Williams Magic Shop. Hey there, Emery, how are you?
Howdy, how are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. And the name of the company, it's Williams Magic, or just Williams Magic.
It's just Williams Magic, that's correct.
Because it's really not a shop or a traveling van or a kiosk. I mean, it can be any or all of the above.
It is all of the above, yes.
Yeah. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you. I want to kind of go back, I guess, in history a little bit to the beginning of this, where that the Williams Magic started with your father there in Tucson, and when and where that got started.
Sure. Well, he actually started back in Missouri. he's been in business over 47 years, and in the late 80s, he moved to Tucson. We discussed it, and we all decided to move to Tucson from various parts of the country. So he moved his magic business out here, and it's been in the same location for 24 years. It continued to grow, and it has been a really, really nice, full-service, old-fashioned brick-and-mortar magic shop. And as magic continues to evolve, we've seen it change drastically over the last 15 years or so. As it began to evolve, we finally came to the conclusion to close that particular location, not by preference or choice, but out of necessity. And we pretty much divided our business interest into three specific focuses. One of them, as you already know, and we can get into later, is the mobile shop that we drive around the country three or four times a year. Another one is the internet, which we're focusing more and more on now, even though we don't like it. And the third one is to maintain a local presence here in the Tucson area. We built a small roadside kiosk in the town of Vail, about 25 miles outside of Tucson. And that is specifically designed for the kids, the beginners, and the tourists that are coming through. So we have a public face as well as a professional service face in the mobile shop just for the professionals. That one does not open to the public. And then our website.
Well, going back, I guess, to the brick and mortar shop that you had there in Tucson with your father for such a number of years, it had a back room where that you had lectures, I guess, come in and performances and private lessons you would give.
We did give lessons. Yes, we had a magic room in the back. We called it the magician's room. And in that shop, we inventoried on our shelves over 6,000 different items, including books, DVDs, and tricks. And so it was – there are still photos around of it. We have photos. I'll probably put some more up on our website. But there – it was really a gathering place. The local magicians would come and hang out even just during business days. Various guys would get off work and come out, and especially on the weekends. And we did teach classes there. We let the local clubs use it for – not for their club meetings, but for media interviews and for practice and for officers' meetings and things of that nature. So it was a gathering room where people just enjoyed hanging out. We built a stage with curtains, the whole works. So it was a fully functional performance area.
And I think that's what's important about the brick-and-mortar shops that people who haven't visited a brick-and-mortar have missed or are missing, and that is the social interaction that magicians have with each other and kind of the learning experience that they have in those kinds of situations.
Well, that's a huge part of it. I mean, we had a lot of very, very excellent and qualified professional magicians who would hang out, and the new guys didn't appreciate the value that they had in being able to sit with them. But the other thing, you mentioned the value of the brick and mortar shop. The other aspect is the brick and mortar shop owners had and still have a different mentality to the internet shop owners today. And that's one of the issues that is beginning to impact brick and mortar shop owners pretty heavily.
And that's really, I guess, the customer service that you can provide only at a brick and mortar, that you really can't have that same social interaction with the dealer to give those kinds of personal recommendations and to show you a different handling and whatnot of tricks if you have a brick and mortar versus just buying it over the internet blindly.
Well, it's that, and there's even more to it. I will not single out any one company anywhere. I'm not saying anything bad about any one company.
Right.
But the basic difference is if you go back 30, 40, 50 years, brick and mortar shops were owned by magicians who loved magic, who had a sincere interest in serving magicians. It may sound kind of corny to say this, but brick and mortar magic shops have never been a profitable business model. They have been run by magicians who really loved magic. Today, the whole society has changed, and your internet shops, as a general rule, again, not singling out anyone, but as a general rule, guys selling on the internet are not in it because they love magic. They're in it because of the profit. And if you talk to them in private, they will admit that it's all about a lot of money to be made, and it's all internet marketing and hype, and they sell anything without regard for the person buying it. So the different mentality is a brick and mortar shop owner has always tried to cultivate a new person into a magic entertainer. They'll take a new person, teach them a trick. They come back, they'll teach them another one. They work them a level by level approach. Whereas on the internet, everything's available. If you got $20, you just download it, whether you can do it or not.
So they're really not considered as a potential magician, but more as just a customer.
Exactly. I've often used the analogy that internet shops may as well be selling snow cones on the side of the road because they don't really care about the person buying it. They're just trying to move product. And that comment comes not just from me. That's from other brick and mortar shop owners and other magicians around the country. If I could interject here, in the last 3.5 years, of running our mobile shop, we have made over 200 club visits in 37 states.
Wow.
And we've met with individual professional magicians in cities that do not even have a club. And we hear the same comments over and over and over on many different issues. So my opinions are not exclusively my own. They are formed partially based on what I hear from other magicians and other shop owners around the country, and in speaking with representatives of wholesalers and other internet retailers. So the whole mentality of magic has changed.
Well, I agree with you, but going back to when you had the brick and mortar shop before the internet came on, that a lot of people were coming into the shop, and again, that you had a place where that you were teaching magic. Once somebody bought the trick, you wouldn't just show them there because there were other customers in the shop, and you kind of took them over to a side place, closed the door, and would teach them the trick privately there.
Absolutely. We had a place that we called the secret place, and it was not a closed room. We were very aware of the potential for allegations of undesirable nature. So we didn't take them into a back room. We actually had a partition that would block the view of what was happening on the countertop, but everyone, including the student and us, was in full view at all times, and we'd just lower our voice and stand there and teach them the secret, and no one else around would be able to see or hear what was happening.
Sure.
And that's a big part of it, because we build the business based on showing someone something, demonstrating a trick. And then once they're interested, because there was never a hard sell, we would show them something, the magic would sell itself. They'd say, how much is it? Can I do it? Yes, I'll take it. Well, then when we walk them over to the secret room or secret place, we would take the time to physically walk them through it, teach every single step of it so that they completely understand it and they're able to do the whatever was required. Then they would have to go home and put their practice into it. So that was a way of guaranteeing their success, and they would enjoy their purchase and want to come back.
But then as the internet developed, I think it was an interesting model that you kind of embraced not only the technology by having your own website, but you had a computer there. So I guess you recognized that there were a lot of people coming in and just price shopping, and so that's why. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We didn't so much embrace the internet voluntarily. It was out of a sense of necessity. We were by no means the first magic shop on the internet, but we were one of the very early ones. We were on with an informational site, not a selling site, mm-hmm. because we recognized the need to have a presence. And then what we discovered over the next few years was the internet sites began to do some pretty aggressive marketing and price cutting. And our customers would come in and say, oh, you've got that. Oh, yeah, I saw that on the internet for $5 cheaper or $10 cheaper. And so the only way that we could verify that or deal with that was to go over to our computer and look it up and say, oh, yeah, you're right. Well, we'll match that price in order to satisfy that customer. Well, that gradually evolved to the point that we actually put a computer out for the public. We put a little kiosk on the customer side of the counter, and we would tell everybody that comes in, we have a computer here for your use. You can search the internet, you can shop around, you can use it to find things, you can use it to check prices. And our official policy became one of, we will match any other legitimate retailer's price as long as you include their shipping. And I shouldn't have said that, because the free shipping came in later. Initially, it was just we would match anyone's price. The free shipping came in because some of the internet-only shops began to offer free shipping. So then that even cut the profit margin more.
Right.
And the only way we could compete was then to match the price, including free shipping, if you include their shipping cost. And if they were looking at a site that didn't charge shipping, then we matched their without shipping. But if they looked at a site with shipping, usually we found that that price would then exceed our price, because that's how the internet game was beginning to be played.
I've talked with other magic dealers about that business model, and they didn't agree that that was such a great idea. I would argue that I thought that it was brilliant, because that you would also get a customer then for life, because they would be coming back in and they know that you were looking out for their best interest as well as for their pocketbook. And so they would come back to your shop and buy that. Even if they found something on the internet, they would go out of their way to come back to your shop to say, hey, look, I already found this, and can you match that price? And you'd say yes. And that way that at least you continue to keep that magician.
You know, we used to think the same thing.
Okay.
That was kind of our motivation for starting that. And we were kind of surprised at how that all evolved. Our whole motivation was to serve the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And one day my dad made the comment, he said, look, we don't want a customer, a regular customer of ours, to become comfortable buying somewhere else. If we had a product at $25 and they see it online for $20 and we said, no, we're sorry, you'll have to go buy it from them. Well, that opens the door. Now they're thinking, well, this other company is cheaper, so let me see what else they have. And that was the motivation for us saying, you know, the only way we can compete with that is to take the actual customer that's standing in front of us and say, we will match that price for you. So we never advertised a lower price, and we never got into cutthroat pricing or marketing. We set our prices very competitively with every magic shop in the country, every brick and mortar shop. Brick and mortar shops have a very high overhead with the lease and the utilities and the air conditioning and everything.
Right.
And the internet shops typically, a lot of them at that time especially, were guys selling out of their basement or their garage. And then they evolved into companies selling out of warehouse districts.
Drop shipping.
But, yes, and drop shipping. But the idea was, if I have a customer standing in front of me, and he says, I can get it somewhere else for $5 less, I would rather take the hit in order to make the sale. And a lot of guys didn't understand that. I would say, you know, I'd rather not make $5 in profit and make $3 in profit than not make any profit at all.
Mm-hmm.
At least I get the sale, and it brings in the issue of cash flow. A brick and mortar shop has to have cash flowing whether there's a large profit or not. And so that began to erode our profit margin, because more and more people would come in and say, oh, I searched on the internet. They do all their searching. And then pretty soon it evolved into them just simply buying on the internet, because if you have an equal playing field of we'll match their price, something else dramatically changed. And that is, internet marketing companies began to hire more and more people to do aggressive emails, and the hype in print and the hype in the videos that started coming out began to dramatically tip the balance in their favor, so that brick and mortar shops like ours began to lose more and more customers who just went, oh yeah, I saw it online, and you know, it looks so good, and they sent me that email, and they offered a special discount, so I just went ahead and ordered it. And so even though we expected more loyalty, the actual loyalty toward the brick and mortar shops began to erode dramatically.
That's surprising, because I would have thought that they would have continued to come back for the immediacy of having that in hand. There, a lot of magic is a point of purchase type of a thing. Whenever that they come into a shop and they say, what's new? You show it to them, you put it on the counter and kind of leave it there, and they're going to walk away with it. They're going to eventually buy it because it's in their hand and they've got it now. It's again a point of purchase and something that they can have, as opposed to getting an email and then they're going to have to wait. I don't care if it's, you know, shipped in 2 days or if it takes 6 days or whatever, if it's coming in from overseas, that, they kind of start to lose a little bit of interest, or there might be some even buyer's remorse and sorry that they'd ordered it. But if they see it at a magic shop, they might purchase it more immediately, I would think. But that's not, wasn't the case. You didn't.
Well, it was for a period of time, but then that began to change. And I'll tell you one other thing that evolved, and another thing that other brick and mortar shop owners disagreed with me heavily on. We began to develop customers who would come in and say, oh, I've ordered this online and I'm having trouble. Can you help me with it?
Mm-hmm.
And so we would, again, out of a sincere desire to help and serve our customers. And other shop owners that I've spoken to say, not on your life. Somebody comes in, they say, I bought this on the internet. Can you help me? Their response was, we'll go back and contact the company you bought it from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our approach was to say, okay, we'll help you with it. And then that gradually evolved into guys who would come in, they'd look around, they'd want to see a demo. Can you show me this? Can you show me that? Can you show me this? Then they'd walk over to the internet and find the lowest possible price. I mean, an absolute cutthroat price. Then come back and say, will you match this price? And we would. And then now they want us to teach them and spend all the same time with them that we would have if they had paid the full price. So we found that we were giving the full service and not making the profit on it, where the internet company would have just put it in the package and shipped it off to them. I actually have a story, and I won't name anyone to protect the guilty, a story from another shop owner, and it's really amazing. He told me that he was in his shop one day, and this young fella in his mid-teens came in, was standing at the counter, and one of his employees was standing on the other side of the counter. And this kid said, can you show me that right there? And the fella said, sure, I can demo that. And he says, okay, thanks. Now, can you show me this over here? And the demonstrator said, sure, I can do that one. And he said, I've got one more I'm looking at. Can you show me this one over here? And the guy said, sure, I can show you that. And then the kid said, okay, thank you. And he took about two steps back from the showcase, and he looked around, and he pulled out his phone and started typing on his phone. And after a minute or so, the demonstrator looked up. And by the way, the shop owner was standing off to the side observing all of this. That's why this is a firsthand story from him. the demonstrator looked up and said, what is it you're trying to look up? Maybe I can answer the question for you. And the kid, without missing a beat, said, oh, no, I don't have a question. He said, I've decided on that one that I want, and I just found it on the Internet for $4 less, and I placed the order.
Just like that?
Just like that. Didn't even ask if you'd match the price, didn't ask any, just said, I just found it on the web, and I placed the order. It'll be coming in next week.
Wow.
Now, that's the mentality that magic shop owners have to deal with today, because we deal with an internet-based and a smartphone-based generation that, again, a totally different subject, has no regard for magic or the shop owner or the no respect for the secrets or anything of that nature. They're just simply shopping for the lowest price. They don't care where it is or how long it takes. Now, this kid didn't even look to see that he was paying an extra $10 shipping to get him for $4 less. You see,
the whole matter of economics, but he wasn't looking at the bottom line. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. They don't look at the bottom line anymore. They just look at the advertised price. Well, it's cheaper, so shipping can't be that much. And what they don't realize is some internet places will charge you $10 shipping to put a couple of playing cards in an envelope and mail it to you.
Well, that's the handling charge.
Exactly. That's the shipping and handling, yes.
Right. Yeah, because as I have shipped out things sometimes, and I say shipping and handling, and if I had someone who actually sent an email back to me and said, well, I can see on the envelope that it only cost, let's say, $2.50, whatever it was, and you charge me $4, you know, for shipping.
Yeah.
And I said, well, there is the bubble pack, there's the envelope, you know, that we had to, you know, plus we had to pay for the internet website, you know, each month, that there's a percent of that, plus, you know, driving to the post office to drop off your package. I said, there's a lot of handling charges. It's not just purely the postage, you know, that's involved.
Right. And those are all legitimate charges. Absolutely. I mean, unless they're just abusing it, but those are all legitimate charges. And the customers today just simply don't care for the most part. They see an ad, they see a slick video with a single angle view, and they just, it's the impulse purchase. It's the gum at the checkout stand mentality. Mm-hmm. Ooh, I need one of those. Boom. They check it out.
Well, you had told me sometime before also about the type of customer that is not really the person who is going to become a magician, but just someone who has a short-term magic interest. I think you had likened it to pigs being fed to a snake kind of a thing. I got to keep moving down. Could you share that analogy? I thought that was a classic.
Okay, now wait a minute. You're going to get me in trouble here if people start saying I'm calling customers pigs being fed to a snake. That had nothing to do with it.
That's exactly right.
Okay. I will explain that in just a second, okay?
Fair enough.
First of all, we have seen a change. Oh, that was good. We have seen a change in the customer mentality over the last 12 or 15 years. And I, after a year or two of seeing this change, I came up with a name for the new typical customer who would come in our door. In the past, magic shops served magicians. It was a magician who would walk in the door and say, I need something for a show. I'm looking for this. I'm looking for whatever. Well, then all of a sudden that group of customers began to phase out, and the new customer base that was coming in, very first words out of their mouth was, hi, haven't been here in a while, what's new? And I'd say, well, this is the new showcase over here, these things are all new. Okay, show me something. So that, first of all, they want something new.
Right.
Then the question is, how much is it? Well, it's $15. Okay, I'll take it. So they buy the trick, we teach them how it's done, they walk out the door. 2 days later, they would come back. And they'd say, oh, that was a lot of fun. I've shown all my friends, and I've shown all my friends' friends, and now I need something new. Mm-hmm. What's new? And so I began to establish for them. I call them puzzle solvers. All they want is a puzzle. They want something that will fool them. If it's not too expensive, they'll buy it so that they can go fool their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then fooled all their friends and shown all their friends how it's done. Then they come back and they want something new. They want another puzzle. And so I've kind of interchangeably used the term puzzle solvers and pranksters. They just want to prank their friends. And that's pretty much where the new mentality of magic began to go. Market started to feed that. Well, there was a problem with that. Before I tell you that problem, there's a secondary issue. As time went by, that even changed. The kid would come in. He would say, I've never been in a magic shop. We'd show them a trick. They'd go, wow, I'll take that. They'd go home. And then we wouldn't see them for 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Well, in the past, we'd see them the next day or two. Ooh, I want to learn more. I'm excited. Well, in 2 or 3 weeks, they'd come back in and we'd say, hey, I haven't seen you in a while. They would say, no, I've been busy, but man, I've been spending a lot of time on the internet. You know, there's a lot of magic out there on YouTube and everywhere. And I'd go, yeah, I know. And they'd say, so what's new? There's the question again.
Right.
And I would answer, well, this is new. And then they'd go, oh yeah, I know how that's done. I saw that on YouTube. Okay, well, how about this over here? This just came out a couple of days ago. Oh, yeah. I know how that's done now, too. What else? And so what's happened is these new people would get a bug. They'd buy a trick. They'd go onto YouTube and start learning everything for free.
And learn the secret, basically.
And learn the secret for free because the new generation has no respect for the secrets. They're very quick to get their few minutes of fame. They want to jump on the internet with a video. They want to show how they open the package and what comes in the package and here's what it does and here's the secret. And, right. And they think that that's great. So what that did then is it made all of the secrets instantly available on the web if you would take time to go look for it. Well, here's where that impacts magic shops in a huge way. You go back again 30, 40, 50 years ago, and a magic shop made a profit on the cheap stuff. And by that, I mean the $3, $4, $10 stuff, the ball and vase, the zigzag cards, the three rope routines. Those items, the beginner things, have a higher profit margin, not a lot of profit in dollars, but a higher profit margin than anything else in the shop. Books do not have a high profit margin. DVDs do not have a high profit margin. Playing cards don't have a high profit margin. But the beginner tricks, the little plastic tricks that kids learn from, those have a higher profit margin. So in the old days, a kid would come in, they would begin to buy magic, and in the process of buying, they would learn the secrets. It's like paying for schooling. You're paying as you go, and now we see this graph, this curving line that goes from zero that begins to climb, which represents the amount of money they're spending in order to learn secrets. Well, they might go on for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, and this chart, this graph, continues to climb. At some point, they begin to recognize all of these secrets, and then they would come in and say, what do you have for me today? And we'd say, well, we have this. And they'd go, oh, yeah, I think I know how that's done. Not because of the internet, mm-hmm. but because they paid for all the secrets.
Right.
I think I know how that's done. That's using long and short cards and rough and smooth, isn't it? And we go, yeah, you're right. See, they're starting to learn. At that point, their buying curve begins to taper off. It curves over the top of the hill and begins to taper down.
The classic bell curve.
Exactly. Well, a bell curve suggests an equal bell on both sides.
Well, yes.
And here's where we get to the pig and the python. Back in the 70s, when I was in school, this pig and the python was a commonly accepted chart for a variety of purposes. And I'm just surprised that more people have not heard about it, but I knew it very well. It was a line that would start out at zero, climb up dramatically, make a huge hump like a hill, and then begin to gradually taper back off and go back to a flat line.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was at the beginning of the process is where this huge hill was. And then at the end of the process, it was continuing to taper down. And the analogy was, if you stand back and look at it, imagine that it's a big long snake and they just ate a pig and there's a great big pig in the middle of its stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole concept was that's how some products were marketed. They'd come along, they'd have a big spike and they'd go down. Well, the problem with the magic shops is this curve, this pig and the python, is very early on in the process. So a new person comes in and all of their was on the higher profit, cheap beginner plastic stuff. That's what gave a magic shop owner profit so that they could afford to pay the rent and pay the utilities and maintain an inventory of books and DVDs and big boxes like square circles and funnels and milk pitchers that rarely ever sell, but they needed them on the shelf. So this early buying of the kids and the beginners is what financed the business operation. And then as that person would move on, their spending would drop and they would become a magician who owns all their props and pretty much knows everything.
Right.
So it would take new people to come in and follow through this bell curve in order for the shop to continue making a profit. Well, the internet changed all that. When you've got a kid that comes in, you sell him a ball and vase, and he goes away for three weeks and comes back and says, oh, I know all of this stuff now. Well, boom, you may have just excised that pig out of the picture. So all of the profitable sales of the new cheap plastic stuff, it's gone. There's no profit coming in. Now the shop owner is expected to inventory the books and the DVDs and the big boxy stuff mm-hmm. without the profitable sales from the new people, because the new people are going online and learning it all for free. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem that brick and mortar shops face now. The profitable portion of the beginner sales, the cheap plastic things, the touristy things, that's been taken away. And now the shops are expected to maintain those big boxy items without the proper resources to pay the bills. And all the brick and mortar shops are facing that problem. And I believe that that's the death knell for brick and mortar shops. The business model doesn't work anymore because the customer base that was paying the bills is no longer there. They're getting all of that knowledge for free on the internet instead of paying for it over the counter.
But before that this happened, I guess, or during the time, I guess, that you had internet sales and before you kind of came to that financial realization that you were going to be closing the physical shop, you had this idea of building this magic shop on wheels. And that came about, I think you were telling me, where that you had a couple of days without any sales even on the internet. Could you kind of go back and tell that story?
Sure. Actually, that idea was a shocking idea to me. I was driving down the road one day, just out of the blue, this whole concept popped into my head. It was like an epiphany. I just had a vision of taking the entire magic shop, loading it into a truck and taking it to a local club, not our local club, but driving it to any local club somewhere. And my brain just right there. I went, wow, what a concept. If we could put everything we have. And part of the reason that came about is we had attended a number of conventions over the years as a dealer, all over the country. And when we did that, we would normally load our car to the hilt. We would pack the trunk and the back seat and the floorboards and under the seats and everything with magic, drive off to a convention, unload everything, set up booths, sell as much as we could, turn around, pack the rest in the car and drive back home. A huge amount of work just with inventory control, if nothing else.
Sure.
And we had done that a number of times. So this day when I was driving down the road and this idea hit me, I thought, wow, instead of loading a car, what if we just put everything in a big truck? And so that idea hit me. Now I'm going to say it's about nine or 10 years ago. And I told my parents the idea and they thought I had gone insane. Because he said, well, there's no way we could do anything like that. Could you imagine how expensive that would be? And my answer was, yeah, but could you imagine? I mean, how awesome would that be? So I kept the idea to myself, and we just ignored it for a number of years. And then in 2008, if you notice, the stock market took a little bit of a dive.
Yeah.
It didn't affect us because we have neither stocks nor money. So we thought, wow, that's not good news, but at least it doesn't really hit us. Well, that Monday morning, we went into our shop, and by that time, our internet business was approaching somewhere around 40% of our overall business.
Mm-hmm.
And that morning, we went in, and that entire day, there was not one single internet order. It was just as though our website had been turned off.
Wow.
And so I went on and checked and made sure, yep, it's still working. And simultaneously, no customers came in the shop physically. I think we had one person walk in the door mid to late afternoon. They were paying a bill next door, and they saw us and walked in. So we only had one customer. The next day, Tuesday, we went into work, and there was not one single internet order. And just like the day before, we had one or two people walk in the door in the afternoon. No sales. The third day, Wednesday, not one single internet order. And then we had a couple of customers walk in the afternoon, and we had a couple of guys come in and say, wow, you know, what about this stock market thing? So clearly that was what was in the news. The fourth day, Thursday, our internet came back. We got one order for $12. That was it. And I turned to my dad and I said, you know, how much longer can we keep paying our lease and do this business if we don't have any customers coming in and if they're not buying on the internet? And his answer was not very long. So I said, you know, you remember that idea I had about loading everything in a truck and driving it around? He said, yeah. I said, I think we need to reconsider that. And he said, there's no way we could do that. And I said, well, if I can find a way to do something with a small truck and a trailer or something, what do you think of the idea? And he said, well, it might be a good idea, but he said, we just can't do it. So that's when I really got serious. It was 2008, and I started searching, and it took me a year and a half, a little over a year and a half, to work out how this would work. I started with the idea of just a small trailer, like a small U-Haul trailer behind a pickup truck. And then I started thinking about spending nights in hotel parking lots with thousands of dollars worth of merchandise sitting out in the parking lot unprotected. And I thought, that's not going to work. So then I moved up to the idea of a small RV and started looking at them and researching. And it gradually got to a bigger RV, and then it got to a longer RV. And then I thought, you know, it's got to be comfortable, because if we're sitting on the side of the road in Kansas City and my wife and I are there and we're sitting there with our knees up against the kitchen sink, rocking back and forth going, I hate this thing, I hate this thing, then that's not going to work.
Right.
So after all of this research, it finally evolved into the largest RV toy hauler fifth wheel that they make. That's a 42-foot long Heartland Cyclone that came equipped with five queen beds, and it had a 14-foot garage enclosed on the backside. We had narrowed it down to about three or four models that size, and we singled that one out. And then I went to a bank and found that they were stupid enough to let me buy it on my signature. Because at that time I had a pretty good credit rating, and I said, what are the chances of my getting this? And they said, sign here. So I went, wow, what's the worst thing that could possibly happen? This whole concept fails. They take it back. Oh well.
Yeah.
So I finally tracked down. By this time, there were only three of these particular units left in the country. It was late 2009. And one was in Utah, one was in Texas, in San Antonio, and one was back in Indiana. And so we negotiated with the guy in Texas and cut the deal on the phone sight unseen. I had seen photographs, but I'd never had a chance to walk into this particular unit. We bought it based on the floor plan and the specs and everything. And we had already done our measurements to know how much space we needed in the garage. So we bought it by phone, and the guy said, I can have it ready for you to pick up on Thursday. And I said, wait, I can't. He said, why not? I said, I don't have a truck. He said, oh, well, what's wrong with your truck? And I said, no, I don't have one.
Nothing if I had one, but I don't have one.
I don't have one at all. I said, I've been shopping. And he said, well, when are you going to get one? And I said, well, I don't know. I've been searching for several months, and I haven't found the right truck. And he said, well – I said, can you hold it for me? He said, well, I'll hold it for a couple of weeks. He said, keep me posted. So then I continued searching, and that RV was new, but I found a used truck here in Tucson. Another RV owner had just traded in to one of the dealers, and they traded in a whole unit, and I was able to buy just the truck, and that's the International 4700 low profile that is in the photo on our website. And it looks like they were painted together, but they were not. One had never seen the other. We bought the truck here in Tucson, paid for it on a Wednesday night, had it delivered to me Wednesday night at 5:30 or 6 o'clock. My wife and I got in it and drove off to San Antonio the following morning, spent the entire day driving down there, spent Thursday night in San Antonio, got up Friday, spent the whole day at the dealership getting the RV. Mm-hmm. When we pulled into their lot and saw the RV and me, I walked up to it, and I didn't say it out loud, but in my head I went, what have I done?
this is huge. Because I was dwarfed by the size of this thing. It was 13 feet tall, 42 feet long, and 8 feet wide, and I walked up to it. It's a big box, and I thought, there is no way I can pull this thing down the road. But I went in, went through with it. We spent the whole day there. We hooked it up, drove it back home, and that was the beginning of the end here. That's we brought it home November of 2009 and spent the next few months custom building the garage. I cut all of the steel and welded it and ground it and painted it and put it in, measured it. We just custom designed the whole thing. And put in rolling racks, which, not to digress, but if anybody cares, they can go to our website, and there is a video on YouTube. You can search on YouTube or go to our website and find it. And there's a video tour inside the magic Porsche that we designed. So,
and the website is williamsmagic.com?
It is, williamsmagic.com, and there are some rotating banners at the top. When you see the RV pop up, click on that. Let me think. Yeah, and that takes you to a page that has a lot more information with photos and description, and then there's a link to the video. But we designed it so that the concept was, in the event of an emergency, this was like a last urgent contingency basis. If something were to happen and we lost our lease or business just deteriorated so badly, we said we have to be able to put everything in our brick and mortar shop in this RV. And so we literally, before we bought it, we went through and measured every shelf in the shop, every bookcase, every DVD case, every showcase. We measured and calculated all of the inventory, and we designed this so that it accommodate every piece of inventory in the shop, from large boxy items and illusions down to playing cards. And that's what took us several months to completely design and build into the back of this RV. Mm-hmm. And then in early 2010, I'm going to say it was around the middle of March, because we were scheduled to go to Stan Kramian's Northwest Magic Jamboree in Oregon that year in April or May. I think it was May. We did our trial run in March, went up to a small club in Prescott, Arizona. They had about 9 or 10 members at the time. Went up there, and we had kept this project a complete secret. Absolutely secret. None of our local magicians knew. At that time, we had a couple of employees in the shop. Neither one of them knew that we were doing this. They had no clue. We did it all undercover. We built the whole thing, and the Prescott Club was the very first club to see or hear about it. And so we just called them one day and said, hey, you know us, Williams Magic in Tucson. We were thinking about coming up to visit you and bring some things. Would that be okay? And they went, sure, come on up. So we parked it outside of their meeting room. Went into the meeting and then said, and our vehicle's outside, and we took them out, and you should have seen the shock on their faces. When they walked in, they just couldn't believe that we had brought thousands of items just to their club. It has since grown into an inventory of about over 4,000 items in there that we travel with. And the very first guy that stepped up blocked the doorway and wouldn't let anybody else come in. He just stopped. Opened his mouth and started looking. And he said, do you carry invisible thread? And I said, I carry 7 different kinds of invisible thread. Which one did you want? And he went, whoa. And he paused and he said, I guess that means you have wax too. And I said, I have 7 different kinds of wax. I said, which part of full service did you not understand? And he laughed. And the reception was really outstanding. They were absolutely happy to see us. So that was a good trial run, and since then we've been running all over the country.
So my question then would be, prospectively, as we start to kind of wrap up here, for the future of brick and mortar shops, if there is any, what are your thoughts on, do you think this is a profitable or working model that people should consider buying a brick and mortar? Should they continue? Do you think after that the people who own them finally retire, or you know, will they sell the shop to the younger people? Do you think they'll disappear? What do you think of the future of brick and mortar?
I don't think it's a pretty picture at all. And one of the reasons is simply the magic society, not any group, but just the general society of magic, has changed so dramatically toward the internet. And I think that there are only two types of magic shops that will continue to be in business at physical locations. And in my opinion, I don't really consider either of them true brick and mortar shops. A brick and mortar shop provides the environment and the ambiance that you and I were discussing at the beginning, a place to gather, a place where people come and chat and share ideas, a place to get counseling and instruction from the owner. That's, to me, a brick and mortar magic shop. I think that they are all doomed, quite frankly. Hmm. We will keep the tourist shops, the Disneyland shops, the Las Vegas shops, the ones where people on vacation can go and spend $10 or $12 to buy a ball and vase, because that's where the profit is, and that's the way that those shops catering to the tourist and the high traffic markets will be able to make a profit. The new people getting into magic are not interested in magic. They're interested in cards. They're interested in pranks. So the traditional brick and mortar shop that carries the big variety of supplies and provides the instruction is no longer in demand. So I think we will keep the tourist shops, the Disneyland shops, the high priced places. And I think we will also keep the occasional little kiosk with the showcase, like the costume shops, which are now having the same problem magic shops are, because of the Halloween wholesalers, the bulk sellers that come in for a month or two before Halloween. Mm-hmm. They're creating similar problems for costume shops. But if the costume shops can stay in business, some of them carry a few magic items. They might have a showcase, but they don't usually have a magician there to demonstrate.
Right.
You're seeing some magic items on pegboards or on spinning metal racks in game shops or in Cracker Barrel shops occasionally. So we're still going to have the occasional little display in the unrelated shops, and we're going to have the high tourist shops. But the traditional brick and mortar shops, I think, are on their way out, because the business model just doesn't work anymore. Everybody has to go to the internet or they're going to fail. They can't pay the lease and the expenses when the customer base is gone.
So over the next 20 years, you're projection is that these will all kind of fade into history, and except for the ones in the high tourist spots.
Yeah,
unfortunately, you know, like old buggy whips just kind of went by the wayside.
Yep, I think so. And you know, it's an arguable point. I know a lot of people disagree with me. I also know a lot of people who do agree with me. A lot of shop owners. I think that magic as a whole is in serious trouble. With the evolution of magic, with the shift toward the puzzle solving and the pranks and the quick hit. Today's kids learn a trick and then they run up to somebody and say, "Hey, you want to see a cool trick? Watch this." Because they've watched too much on television where right. that is showcased.
Right.
And so the new kids are not learning to be entertainers. They're not learning to be magicians. And as a result, they're not buying from the shops. So the shops are going to continue to close. I have to say, in every trip that we've taken, anywhere in the country, on every single trip, I find another one or two or three shops that have either just closed or are in the process of closing, or will confide in me that they're going to be closing in the next few months but keep it quiet because they haven't told their customers. And so it is a regular ongoing thing. We are losing hundreds and hundreds of shops on a regular basis. And so as those shops dry up and the kids now don't have that local environment to go in and be mentored by other local magicians, and of course the new kids are not interested in the magic clubs because there's quite a disparity between age and interest there.
True.
The shops are beginning to fail and have been for a number of years. As they dry up, then we're going to continue the process and lose wholesalers and manufacturers. You know, we've already lost Morrissey in Canada. They just closed several months ago. That was a premier aluminum manufacturer.
Right, for cups and balls and loaded bowls.
Yep.
And all that.
Mm-hmm. And all the dove pans and the coin pails and funnels and things like that.
Is Mac Magic still around?
Mac is still around, but the problem is the market for the products that they make, Mac and everybody else, the market has dried up. The people are not buying those items anymore. They're the latest, greatest card effect, you know, the mm-hmm. latest, greatest hit and run type effect.
They don't want the box tricks.
That's right, at all. And so with the shops closing and then we're losing, we will lose wholesalers and manufacturers. Well, then if the kids begin to wake up in the next 10, 15 years, they're not going to have resources for these products. Where you can go into a shop now and buy a square circle for under $100, if somebody wants one 4, 5, 6 years from now, they'll be paying a custom price of $200 or $300 for someone to build one for them because nobody's manufacturing them, you know, on a mass scale anymore. So I see a real famine, if you will, of magic coming. I think we're going to see a dramatic drop off in magic as you and I know it. We're going to see an increase in the puzzle solving and the pranks, but we're going to see a drop off in magic, and we're going to begin to see a loss of magic entertainers. And then after a period of time, it'll gradually come back around. It'll be a cycle, but I don't think it will cycle back in my lifetime.
Yeah, everything is cyclical. You know, it's a pendulum, whichever way it's swinging. And yeah. I think you're right. It's probably going that way. And then, after our lifetime in the next generation or generations from now, it'll swing back again and become popular. But I think we've kind of lost the heyday of the brick and mortar magic shops for sure.
The shops and the professional entertainers. I mean, we still have a lot of really outstanding professional entertainers.
Sure.
One of our good friends here in Tucson, John Schrock, is awesome. Mm-hmm. If you don't know him or if your listeners are not familiar with him, he's a local Tucsonan. He grew up and learned magic in Tucson. He is absolutely world class. He's a regular at the Magic Castle. He used to work at Caesar's Magical Empire regularly. He works cruise ships. He works regularly in Hawaii and all over the world.
Yeah,
he's phenomenal.
Wanted to learn more about that. Actually, I did a podcast exclusively with John just a while back. So if they just do a search on themagicwordpodcast.com, they can look for John Schrock and hear that podcast we did together.
Yeah. Well, people like him still have work. Even he is noticing that the work is drying up because of the infiltration of all the secrets being exposed, all the kids doing tricks, all the people getting kind of tired of the pranks. So he's noticing a drop in business, but he's still a professional and he still has work. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to see his caliber of entertainer come along as frequently as we have in the past because they're not in the pipeline. They're not in the process of learning magic. They're still learning pranks. And so this whole cycle is somewhat depressing for the future of magic. It's changing so dramatically.
I would like to think, though, that in being optimistic, taking the other side of what you're saying, that these card tricks and close-up and everything might be a gateway to other kinds of larger things. And I'm saying that for an example. I remember, so far back in the 60s or whatever, when there was the pop wine coming out, like Annie Greensprings and Boone's Farm and all this, and the vineyards, the winemakers were saying this is horrible because this is so popular and college students are drinking it and it's just, a sweet wine. But as it turned out, they started embracing that. The reason being is that people who were drinking that wine to begin with found after a while this is too sweet, but they started to have a refined taste to enjoy wine and the better tasting wine. So they moved from the sweeter wines into something that was more sophisticated, and thus they had people who would buy wines for the rest of their life because they started off with this wine and it's like, that's not bad. And then kind of one thing led to another. So I'm thinking, again, optimistically, that if some magicians get involved with this, that they might say, okay, I would like to learn more about something else. As we know, there are many rooms in this big castle we call magic. And so that they might enjoy this room for a while and they'll realize there's something else over next door and kind of move over. So maybe in the future, there might be more of this growth.
Well, I agree with you on that, and that's what I mean by it will cycle back in years to come, because as these new people, many of them are going to lose interest because it's a passing fad. See, magic has become a fad. It's no longer an art. It's a fad. And as they move past the fad, then there will be the few who, as you say, will go, hey, I want to learn a little bit more about that. That's where the first problem will come in, that they won't have the brick and mortar shops to go to learn that, and they will have limited resources. But then it's going to take those few people to begin to recreate their own things, to begin to learn how to perform and how to entertain on their own. And small groups will start to get together and they'll start cliquishness meetings, and then they will keep their secrets to themselves, and they will begin to gradually develop into tomorrow's entertainers. But I don't see that happening for a while, because it's the old saying, when you're up to your rear end in alligators, you know, there's nothing you can do right this minute. It's too late for the shops of today, right. I think.
Well, I appreciate your perspective, and also the history of kind of what's happened with Williams Magic, and wish you the best and success for the remaining years, and how that's working out with you. And I guess this year you're going to be going to some other Magic conventions and being a dealer, and then being on the road with your van.
Well, we pretty much stay away from the conventions these days. There are very few that we go to for a couple of reasons. One, they don't lend themselves to driving our RV into the dealer room. And so it makes it a little bit difficult to load and unload at each of the conventions. We do it. And also, I'm not saying anything bad about conventions at all, but it doesn't really benefit us to go to a convention any more than it does for us to go on a trip. Because when I go into a local club, it's like my own mini convention. The people come out and I'm the only dealer. And when I go to a convention, there are 10, 15, 20, 30 other dealers in competition. So we generally stay away from the conventions unless there's a special reason. Some of them will let us park at the facility. That's another problem. Most hotels don't allow us to park there, but some of them will. And there are a number of conventions now that are begging us to come, so they are asking us to come for free. Well, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to pay to go to a convention when there's another one that wants us to come for free and then go. So we don't really plan to hit conventions unless this odd random one comes up. We do plan some more trips. Our trips run anywhere from a week or so up to the longest one we made was 8 weeks. And we're considering another trip this summer, possibly. We don't have any plans yet. But we're considering a trip all the way over into the New England area across the U.S. and into undiscovered territory. So, yeah, we do intend to continue running the RV. Right now it's parked here at home. We use it as a storage facility for our internet business and for our local shop. We've divided our inventory between three locations. We have our primary internet warehousing, plus we have the RV warehousing. We have our local shop here in Vail, the kiosk, which has about 1,000 items in it. So we've actually decided to put our money where our mouth is. When I say that the brick and mortar model doesn't work anymore, that's why we had to change. So this little, very small kiosk absolutely targets the beginners, the kids, and the tourists mm-hmm. who come by. We carry things there for professionals, so people are surprised when they come up. A magician might be passing through town and say, oh, what an interesting little place. I bet you don't have a scotch and soda, do you? And I say, absolutely. And they'll go, oh, really? Oh, do you have a silver, copper, brass? Yes, I do. So we carry a lot of things for professionals there. But the whole focus is the kids. And then we leave the professional focus to the RV. So, yeah, we'll be on the road. We're not out of business. We're not disappearing anywhere. We just had to evolve. Like it or not, we had to change how we do business.
I think you have to do that. And very well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate you being a guest today and for your perspective then as well. So thank you, Emery. That was Emery Williams with Williams Magic.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
You're welcome. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out.